They met in person only four times, yet it was upon these two men that the outcome of the Civil War and the future of the nation hung. Ulysses S. Grant and Robert E. Lee have each been the subject of innumerable biographies, but never before have they been paired as they are in this dual biography, Crucible of Command. Ulysses S. Grant and Robert E. Lee, the war they fought, the peace they forged. Three-time Jefferson Davis Award winner William C. Davis looks at these two men simultaneously, presenting them not as the myths time has turned them into, but as complex men with very different and yet strikingly similar personal and professional lives. Again, the title of the book is Crucible of Command. It's a pleasure to welcome William Davis to the program. Thank you very much for being with us, sir.
It's delightful to be with you, Joe. Thank you.
Very nice to have you here. Given your background and how much you have written on this subject, at what point did you realize that it would become necessary and something that you wanted to do to write a dual biography of these two men?
Well, oddly enough, it's something I had never really thought of at all until a couple of years ago during a question and answer period when I was lecturing someplace. Somebody asked a question regarding Lee and Grant, and I began to deliver an answer that was entirely off the cuff, but it slowly turned into a lecture by itself. And my wife sort of suggested afterward, gee, you ought to think about doing a book on that. And the more I thought about it, the more I liked the idea of it, particularly the approach of dealing with them as men and as personalities rather than as necessarily commanders in battle. That's been done before several times, and much good work has been done about it, but I was more interested in their world views, their ethical and moral codes, the developments of their personalities, their private lives, that sort of thing. The sort of things that with all of us, as we're growing up and maturing, wind up informing the way we make decisions ultimately. And of course, these men had to make huge decisions indeed.
Yes, it is not a conventional biography in the sense that you are not detailing every incident of their lives. And as you say, you're looking at their moral and ethical worlds. So you're digging into how they made decisions and the ways that their mind worked and their personal relations. So from that, what do you learn about these two?
In the way they made decisions is where perhaps the greatest similarity and at the same time one of the greatest differences between them appears. One quality they both have in common is that they are very bold. They're willing, they have the kind of personality and character that can take an enormous gamble, realizing that with everything on the line, failure could be not just disaster for them, but for their nation. Sort of like the Harry Truman decision to drop the bomb. They could make the tough decision and go to bed and get a night's sleep and carry on. But at the same time, the ways they came to those decisions do differ. Lee very much decided things on his own, rarely resorted to so-called councils of war. Grant, on the other hand, would seek opinions from a number of his subordinates in appropriate fields of endeavor, but then he would make the decision alone and by himself as well. And they were both willing. That's probably the biggest single characteristic they have in common. They are willing to make the decision that they know is going to send perhaps thousands of men to their deaths in order to presumably achieve the aim or an aim of the cause they're serving.
I touched on this in the introduction, but you make the point in the book that, especially with Lee, but with Grant as well, that in dealing with the real man is very different than the man that many of us prefer to remember him being, and that isn't the same thing.
No, they're not. That's the case with both of them, in fact. One problem I knew in advance that I was going to have in the reaction to the book, and actually I've already seen it in the just one or two reviews that have appeared, is that there would be a perception that I was somehow very pro-Grant and very anti-Lee, which is not the case at all. The fact is there's a lot of myth that's grown up around both of them. The myth that's grown up around Lee is almost uniformly very positive and flattering. The myth that's grown up around Grant is almost uniformly unflattering and negative. cut through all of that, I essentially wind up sort of deconstructing a lot of favorable Lee myths, which makes it sound as if I'm somehow anti-Lee at the same time that I'm trying to point out that Grant was really not the character that the unfavorable myths about him present. I despair of ever convincing anybody that I really have no bias toward one or the other. That's just going to be in the nature of reactions to the book. But neither, in fact, really matches the myth that grew up around him.
I also found it fascinating because you cite that there's a 32-volume papers of Ulysses S. Grant, and that there really is nothing comparable for Lee. So in some ways, there's a more incomplete picture of him.
In some ways, yes. People have, on a few occasions in recent years, discussed the idea of perhaps trying to compile a Robert E. Lee papers project. His papers are widely scattered. They're voluminous in quantity. The problem is there are still, as recently as a few years ago, there are still a number in private hands in the Lee family that were not being released. And there were other Lee papers that are now in the Library of Congress and elsewhere that were still under wraps. That is, historians are not allowed to have access to their content. And the feeling has been, until you can get at everything that's known, there's no point in doing it. Lee collected papers work. There have been a couple of things done years ago. Lee's wartime correspondence that was known as of the 1960s has been compiled into a volume. And there's another volume that was done years ago of his correspondence with Jefferson Davis. Both are now dated. But at least there's that to go on. There are also some very substantial websites at Washington and Lee University and the Virginia Historical Society that include some of Lee's voluminous correspondence. But it's quite true that even the Grant papers, all 32 volumes, isn't really one-stop shopping. There's still a lot of work you have to do outside the papers. But we don't even have that for Lee, so it requires some extra hustle.
You talk about the importance of your research in dealing with papers from that time, either papers that the men have written themselves or was written by contemporaries about them, but that when it came to books written later, you actually used those sources far less.
Very sparingly, in fact, and that is in no way meant as a criticism of some fine later works, including biographies done of both of them. My goal simply was to try to compile this portrait based on what is closest to the men themselves, which would be their own words at the time or the words of people who knew them and who were present contemporaneously with Grant and Lee. There is simply no way that any historian, myself included, can avoid, in coming to conclusions, injecting some degree of personal viewpoint or perhaps even bias, just as I was discussing earlier. And I didn't want to run the risk of my portrait being overly influenced by some very persuasive biographers who've published on both of those men over the last century and a half. There are those who may argue with that approach, and that's fine. It's certainly open to a question, because I may also have missed some very good conclusions that people have made that I might like to piggyback on. But I preferred as much as possible for my conclusions to be my own, based on what they had to say. This includes not really using Grant's memoirs. And right after his death, he published a two-volume memoir that is still regarded as one of the greatest American memoirs ever written. And it really is wonderfully readable. It sounds just like him. And Grant's a fairly easygoing, even-tempered fellow. But even he could not escape the human tendency to try to gloss over or explain away, rationalize things that he did 20 years earlier during the war that he later wished he had not done. That's one of the problems with all memoirs and autobiographies, is that the authors tend to try to present themselves in the best possible light after the fact, and I try to avoid that.
William Davis is our guest. The name of the book, Crucible of Command, Ulysses S. Grant and Robert E. Lee, The War They Fought, The Peace They Forged. I mentioned in the introduction that they only met a handful of times, four times. Talk a little bit about, even given that, how intertwined their lives were.
Well, really, you could have one without the other, but it wouldn't be easy. And Grant was already wonderfully successful when he first encountered Lee on the battlefield in spring of 1864. Lee, of course, had been wonderfully successful for 2 years at that point, but neither was ever up against an adversary as wily, as resolute, as imaginative as each found in the other. So it presented new challenges to both of them. Lee, of course, was heavily outnumbered, but he had the advantage of knowing Virginia intimately, or having intimate knowledge of the Virginia landscape available to him among his staff and officers. And acting on the defensive actually gave him some advantages at times, whereas Grant was operating in a country he'd never seen before and having to maintain long lines of supply and communications, which were always subject to being raided by Confederate cavalry. Their pluses and minuses tended somewhat to balance out. But Grant was forced to approach Lee as no one else ever had, which was he just had to keep fighting and keep fighting and keep fighting, rather than fight, suffer defeat, and turn back and refit his army and come back again a month or two later. Lee imposed on Grant the necessity of fighting a kind of war that Grant would rather not have fought. He really wanted to fight a war of maneuver that wouldn't be heavily costly in lives, but Lee gave him no option but to fight that way. And Grant, in turn, gave Lee no room for breath by keeping him occupied constantly, by wearing down his army. He hit Lee with something that Lee had never encountered before. It's ironic, in a way, that later in their lives, when each was asked who the best general was he faced, Grant did not name Lee, and Lee did not name Grant. I'm kind of convinced that the degree of frustration, perhaps even something approaching trauma from time to time, that each inflicted on the other was such that they simply didn't want to admit how tough it had been fighting each other.
You address this in the book and just touched on it a moment ago, but what are the traits that made each man a leader, a good leader?
For a start, both were very well informed. Both paid a lot of attention, Grant especially, but also Lee, to the matter of logistics. In Grant's case, he had been a quartermaster back before the war when he was in the peacetime army, and perhaps that made him especially conscious of the need to have supply and transportation and all the other matters of logistics well in hand in advance in order to keep his army moving. Lee was very good at logistics as well. They both had an instinct to fight quickly, to get the job done rather than let the war drag on. Lee, in fact, tended to still cling to a somewhat Napoleonic notion of a climactic battle, one great Armageddon sort of battle that would decide the war. The changes in weaponry and tactics really made that pretty much impractical by the 1860s. Grant had that hope somewhat early on as well, but by the time they meet each other, he realizes it's just going to have to be a war of organization. Grant's an especially organized commander in the field.
And a humility as well? Sharing a humility?
They do. Lee, of course, is one of the Lees of Virginia. He bears one of the finest old names of Virginia. There's no question that Lee is conscious that he is a Lee, and he carries that burden with him always. But you find virtually no egotism or conceit in Lee. When he says he would rather not have been in command of the army, I think he's probably being sincere. Grant, on the other hand, did not really come from humble beginnings, but he certainly wasn't an aristocrat. But I think perhaps Grant's record of business setbacks and some disappointment in his earlier military career were such that he was familiar enough with the hazards of failure that he didn't take himself too seriously. There's also no sign of conceit or ego or vainglory in Grant. He looks like a simple man. And indeed, in some ways, they were both rather simple men, but they both had very complex instincts. And that may be one of the things that made them great commanders.
You paint a picture where Grant is the incurable optimist, always expecting to win. Lee, much more pessimistic, even fatalistic, you point out, hoping to win, but ultimately believing that it was in God's hands.
Yeah, Lee makes a really interesting metaphysical journey. When he's a young man, he shows virtually no interest in religion at all. His surviving letters are virtually silent on the topic. When he married, his wife began to nag him, or tried to nag him into becoming more concerned with the church. And even that didn't really work. But something happened with Lee, probably beginning in the war with Mexico, when he saw a lot of carnage and a lot of friends killed or maimed on the battlefield. As a result, by about 1850, his thoughts about an almighty and about the nature of the metaphysical universe begin to creep more and more into his letters. And by the time the war itself comes on, he's pretty much a confirmed providentialist. It's a pretty unhappy, kind of a downer sort of view. Essentially, God controls everything, man controls nothing, everything that happens on earth is not really being done by men. They're simply carrying out God's will, and it's their duty as men to put up with all the suffering and disappointment they'll have in this life until they die, and then they'll go to paradise and be happy. It's not a real bright and sunny outlook. But one thing I realize that it does do, if God is in fact responsible for everything, that kind of frees a general's hands to take great risks. Because after all, if it fails, the failure was ordained by God, and it's not really the general's responsibility. I think Lee felt free to take colossal risks, trusting that if God intended him to be victorious, he would be.
Part of the subtitle of the book is The War They Fought, The Peace They Forged. And as we wind up our conversation, I'm hoping you can talk a little bit about how each man helped shape the direction of the post-war nation.
Well, Lee first, and this is one of the areas in which there's a pretty thick crust of myth that needs to be cut through. We've been given this vision of Lee as the magnanimous, as the man who's almost grateful to Grant for defeating him because now the Union can come back together. Lee, who held no remorse and felt no recrimination toward his former foe. That's simply not true. When the war ended, Lee acquiesced. He had no choice. But Lee never accommodated. He never really assimilated back into the old Union. He developed during the war something akin to a genuine hatred of Yankees. And he could set that aside at the end of the war, but he could not set it aside entirely. He, for instance, after 1865, never refers to himself as an American. He always refers to himself as a Virginian. But what he did do was realize that recrimination and hatred would be the doom of the post-war South, that they had to get beyond the war. And so Lee makes of himself an example of what he counsels all former Confederates to do, which is to accept the result of the war. Doesn't mean they have to like it or agree with it, but accept it and move on. Stop talking, stop trying to fight in Congress, stop trying to refight the old battles again. Instead, go to work to rebuild the South, start farming again, to rebuild the products of the soil, start universities and colleges and schools again, as Lee, of course, does with Washington College, in order to educate the young men of the South. In short, begin building the new South as a part of the Union, rather than somehow or other resisting reunification. He had nothing whatever to do with a host of former Confederate generals who would spend the rest of their lives engaged in bitter partisan infighting over which general lost which battle. He had no patience with that. Grant, on the other hand, really wants a peaceful reunification. He completely mirrors what Lincoln desired in that regard. And to the best of his ability and good faith, he tried to carry out what he believed to be Lincoln's view toward reunification. When he's president, he pushes forward the 15th Amendment to the Constitution. He tries best he can to bring about a reunification without military reconstruction, which unfortunately he was not successful. Several of the Deep South states simply were not going to go along, though Virginia did not have to go through Reconstruction, thanks in part to Lee's example and the example of men like him. Grant tried to reach out to former Confederates, indeed to people of all stamp, at all stripe, to be a unifier. He was not uniformly successful at it, but he certainly tried. Indeed, one of the first things he did on becoming president and moving into the White House was via a back door discreetly get an invitation to Lee to come call on him at the White House. And Lee, in fact, did make a visit there in April of 1869, and they met for something less than an hour. No one else was in the room, but apparently what they discussed was that Grant was trying to press Lee to speak out publicly, which Lee was refusing to do, advocating peaceful reunification, going back to work, accepting the 15th Amendment, and Lee simply wouldn't agree to get involved in anything that smacked of politics. So they're both trying to bring about good peace, though via different avenues.
It's a fascinating study. The book is Crucible of Command, Ulysses S. Grant and Robert E. Lee, The War They Fought, The Peace They Forged. The book is published by Tekapo. William C. Davis, thank you so much for spending time with us. I greatly appreciate your expertise.
I've enjoyed it, Joe. It's great fun. Thanks for calling.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, Crucible of Command, published by Tekapo, by William C. Davis. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.